An Osho Talk. Walking in Zen, sitting in Zen.
Talks on Zen Stories, number 8.
The first question. How is it possible that Gurdjieff needed another head, an Ouspensky, to work on a third psychology, the psychology of the Buddhas, while you work by yourself, and you can be both in the state of mind and no mind? There have been two kinds of masters in the world. The one kind, the first, has always needed somebody else to express, to interpret, to philosophize, to communicate what the master has experienced. Gurdjieff is not alone in that. He needed P.D. Ouspensky. Without Ouspensky, he would have been not known at all. Ramakrishna comes in the same category. He needed a Vivekananda. Without Vivekananda, Ramakrishna would have remained absolutely unheard of. So is the case with many masters. For the simple reason that their whole work consisted on the heart center. They became crystallized in the heart center. So much so that it was impossible for them to move to the head and to use their own head. It appeared far easier for them to use somebody else's head rather than their own. But there was a difficulty in it. One thing was good about it. The master himself was not constantly moving between two extremes, from mind to no mind, from no mind to mind. There was no movement in his being. He was absolutely crystallized. But another kind of trouble was there. The man who was being used as a medium, Ouspensky, Vivekananda, or others, was himself not an enlightened person. Gurdjieff could use Ouspensky's head, but not exactly the way he would have liked it. Ouspensky's own mind is bound to color Gurdjieff's experience, is bound to bring his own prejudices, his own philosophy, his own understanding to it. He has no experience of his own. He is simply a medium. But the medium is not just an empty vehicle. He has his own mind, and anything passing through his mind is going to be change a little bit here, a little bit there. Ouspensky introduced Gurdjieff to the world, but introduced Gurdjieff in his own way. One cannot blame Ouspensky. What he can do? He tried his best. I think he was one of the best interpreters that any master had ever been able to find. But still, an interpreter is an interpreter. It can't be the same. It is impossible to be the same. Hence, sooner or later, they were to depart from each other. In the last days of Ouspensky's life, he became almost an enemy to Gurdjieff. He started saying that now Gurdjieff has gone mad. First, he was moving in the right direction, but the letter Gurdjieff has gone astray. He could not say that the whole of Gurdjieff's teaching is wrong, because his own teaching was based on Gurdjieff's teaching. But he divided Gurdjieff into two. The first part of Gurdjieff, when Ouspensky was with him, is right, and the latter part is wrong. In fact, the latter part is the culmination of the first part. But why this happened? It was almost bound to happen. Because sooner or later, Ouspensky's own mind was going to become a barrier. First, when he came to Gurdjieff, he was absolutely surrendered to him. Surrendered in the sense that he was fascinated with his personality. Fascinated intellectually, because he was a great intellectual. Absolutely surrendered in the intellectual sense, not in the existential sense. If he was existentially surrendered, he would have been of no use, because Gurdjieff needed a head. He was in search of a head. He had many other followers who were devoted to him from their very innermost core, but they were not going to become his interpreters to the world. When Ouspensky came to Gurdjieff, he was already a world-famous mathematician, a philosopher. His own book, Tertium Organum, had already been translated almost in all the great languages of the world. And that book, Tertium Arganum, is really something tremendous, coming out of a man who is unenlightened. It is almost a miracle. Intellectually, he managed something which nobody has ever been able to manage. He knows nothing. He has not experienced anything, but his intellectual grasp, his intellect is really sharp. He belongs to the topmost intellectuals of the whole history of humanity. There are very few competitors to him. Only once in a while, Socrates had such a man, Plato. Socrates was the heart of the teaching. Plato was the head. Exactly the same was repeated in the case of Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff was the heart. Ouspensky became the head. And if I have to choose between the two, my choice will be Ouspensky, not Plato. Ouspensky is simply unbelievable. His insight without any self-realization is so accurate that anybody who has not experienced will think that Ouspensky is a Buddha, is a Christ. Only a Buddha will be able to detect the flaws, otherwise not. The flaws are there, but ordinarily undetectable. He started writing books on Gurdjieff. He wrote one of his greatest contributions, In Search of the Miraculous. Then he wrote The Fourth Way. And these two books introduced Gurdjieff to the world. Otherwise, he would have remained an absolutely unknown master. Maybe few people would have come into his personal contact, would have become benefited. But Ouspensky made him available to millions. But as those books became spread all over the world and thousands of people started moving towards Gurdjieff, Ouspensky also became very egoistic, naturally, because he was the cause of the whole thing. In fact, he started thinking, without me, what is Gurdjieff? Who is Gurdjieff without me? Who he was? When I had met him, he was just a refugee. Living in a refugee camp in Constantinople. Almost starving. Nobody had ever heard about him. I have made him world famous. The whole credit goes to me. This idea went into his head. It became too much for him. He started in subtle ways to dominate the movement. And you cannot dominate a man like Gurdjieff. You cannot dictate a man like Gurdjieff. they had to depart. In the last days of his life, Ouspensky was so much against Gurdjieff that he would not tolerate anybody mentioning Gurdjieff's name to him. In his presence, Gurdjieff's name was not mentioned. Even in his books, Gurdjieff's name was reduced to only G. The full name disappears. After the break, just G remained. Somebody anonymous. G said, not Gurdjieff. And he made it clear, very clear, that we have departed and I have developed my own system. He started gathering his own followers. Those followers were not allowed to read Gurdjieff's books. Those followers were not allowed to go and see Gurdjieff. While Ouspensky was alive, he was very much suspicious of anybody who wanted to go to Gurdjieff, even wanted to study his books. But Gurdjieff was aware that this is going to happen. Still, there was no other way. Some had has to be used. Gurdjieff himself's work was such that he was absolutely crystallized in his heart. He could not move to the head. So was the case with Ramakrishna. Vivekanand was an ordinary intellectual, not even of the caliber of Gurdjieff. But he made Ramakrishna world famous. Ramakrishna died very early. That's why Vivekananda and Ramakrishna never departed. Otherwise, the departure was absolutely certain. But Ramakrishna died, and Vivekananda became whole and soul. He dominated all the followers. He dominated the whole movement. He became, for them, the representative of Ramakrishna. If Ramakrishna had lived, the same thing would have happened sooner or later, because Vivekananda was just head and nothing else, nothing of the heart. Even if he talks about the heart, it is head talk. Head talking about the heart. It is not heartful. There is no love in it. There is no meditation in it. There is no prayer in it. Just intellectual analysis. He knew the scriptures. And he forced his ideas on Ramakrishna's ideas. And Ramakrishna died. So there was nobody to say no to it. Vivekananda destroyed the whole beauty of Ramakrishna. But that was going to happen, because Ramakrishna was not a man of head at all. But this has not been always the case. Buddha never depended on anybody else. He was capable of moving from mind to no mind, from no mind to mind. That is his greatness. That is far greater an achievement than Guruji or Ramakrishna. Because their achievement is in a way limited. Buddha is very liquid. He is not solid like a rock. He is more fluid like a river. So was the case with Lao Tzu. He never depended on anybody else. He has said whatsoever he was to say. He had said it himself. And as beautifully as it can be said. And their philosophies are bound to be far more purer. Because they come from the original man. They come from the original realization. From the very source. There is no via media. So is the case with Zarathustra, Jesus, Krishna, Mahavira. This is the second category of masters. The first category is easier in a way. It is easy to be crystallized at one center. It is a far complex process. And a longer journey, far more arduous, to remain alive on both the extremes. These are the two extremes, the head and the heart. But it is possible. It has happened before. It is happening right now in front of you. I live in silence. But my work consists of much intellectual communication. I live in silence, but I have to use words. But when I use words, those words contain my silence. I don't need anybody else to interpret me. Hence there is far more a possibility that whatsoever I am saying will remain pure for a longer period of time. And now, many more scientific developments have happened since Buddha. We don't know what actually Buddha said. Although he never used anybody like Ouspensky or Plato or Vivekananda, he himself was his interpreter. But there arose a problem when he died. He spoke for 42 years. He became enlightened when he was about 40. And then he lived up to 82 years. 42 years he was speaking morning, afternoon, evening. Now there was no scientific methods to record what he was saying. When he died, the first question was, how to collect it all? He had said so much. 42 years is a long time. And many had become enlightened in these 42 years. But those who have become enlightened have become crystallized in their hearts. Because that is easier, simpler. And people tend
to move to the simplest process, to the shortcut. Why bother? If you can reach to a point directly straight, then why go roundabout? And when Buddha was alive, there was no need for anybody else to interpret him. He himself was his spokesman. So the need was never felt. There were thousands of arhatas and bodhisattvas. They all gathered. In the gathering, only those were called who had become enlightened. Obviously, because they will not misinterpret Buddha. And that's true. They cannot misinterpret. It is impossible for them. They had also experienced the same universe of the beyond. They have also moved to the farther source. But they all said, we have never bothered much about his words. Since we became enlightened, we had listened to him because his words were sweet. We have listened to him because his words were pure music. We have listened to him because just listening to him was a joy. We have listened to him because that was the only way to be close to him. Just to sit by his side listening to him was a rejoicing. It was a benediction. But we have not bothered what he is saying. Once we attained, there was no need. We were not listening from the head, and we were not collecting in the memory. Our own heads and memories have stopped functioning long before. Somebody became enlightened 30 years before Buddha died. Now for 30 years, he had been sitting there by the side of Buddha, listening as one listens the wind passing through the pine trees, or one listens to the song of the birds, or one listens the rain falling on the roof. But they were not listening it intellectually. So they said, we have not carried any memory of it. Whatsoever he must have said was beautiful. But what he said, we cannot recollect it. Just to be with him was such a joy. It was very difficult now how to collect his words. The only man who had lived for 42 years continuously with Buddha was Ananda. He was his personal attendant, his caretaker. He has listened to him almost every word that he has uttered was listened by Ananda. Even if he was talking to somebody privately, Ananda was present. Ananda was almost always present like a shadow. He had heard everything whatsoever had fallen from his lips. And many things he must have said when there was nobody. Must have said to Ananda. They must have talked. Just going to bed in the night. Ananda used to sleep in the same room just to take care. He may need something in the night. He may feel cold. He may feel hot. He may like the window to be opened or closed. Or he may feel thirsty and will need some water or something. Or he was getting old. He may feel sick. So Ananda was there continuously. They all said, we should ask Ananda. But then there was a very great problem. Ananda was not yet enlightened. He had heard everything of Buddha, uttered publicly, uttered privately. They must have gossiped together. There was nobody else who could have said that I am friendly to Buddha except Ananda. And Ananda was also his cousin brother. And not only a cousin brother, but 2 years older than Buddha. So when he had come to be initiated, he asked few things before initiation, because in India, the elder brother has to be respected, just like your father. Even the cousin elder brother has to be respected just like your father. So Ananda said to Buddha, before I take initiation, once I have become your bhikkhu, your sannyasin, I will have to follow your orders, your commandments. Then whatsoever you say, I will have to do it. But before that, I order you 3 things. As an elder brother, remember these 3 things. First, I will always be with you. You cannot say to me, Ananda, go somewhere else, do something else. You cannot send me to some other village to preach, to convert people, to give your message. This is my first order to you. Second, I will be always present. Even if you are talking to somebody privately, I want to listen everything. Whatsoever you are going to say in your life, I want to be an audience to it. So you will not be able to tell me that this is a private talk, you go out. I will not go. Remember it. And thirdly, I am not much interested in being enlightened. I am much more interested in just being with you. So if enlightenment means separating from you, I don't care a bit about it. If even after enlightenment I can remain with you, only then I am willing to be enlightened. Otherwise, forget about it. And Buddha nodded his yes to all these three. He had to. He was younger to Ananda, and he followed his whole life those three things. The conference of the Arhatas and the Bodhisattvas decided that only Ananda can relate, and he has a beautiful memory. And he has heard everything very attentively. But the problem is, he is not yet enlightened. We cannot rely upon him. His mind may play tricks. His mind may change things unconsciously. He may not do it deliberately. He may not do it consciously, but he has still a great unconscious in him. He may think he has heard that Buddha said this, and he may never have said it. He may delete few words, he may add few words, who knows? And we don't have any criterion, because many things that he has heard, only he has heard. There is no other witness. And Ananda was sitting outside the hall. The doors were closed and he was weeping outside on the steps. He was weeping because he was not allowed. 84-year-old man, weeping like a child. The man who has lived for 42 years with Buddha is not allowed in. Now, he was really in anguish. Why he did not become enlightened? Why he did not insist? He made a vow, a decision, that I will not move from these steps unless I have become enlightened. He closed his eyes. He forgot the whole world. And it is said within 24 hours, without moving from his posture, he became enlightened. When he became enlightened, he was allowed in. Then he related all these scriptures were related by Ananda. But who knows? He became enlightened afterwards. All those memories belong to the mind of an unenlightened person. Even though he has become enlightened, those memories are not of an enlightened person. It is not absolutely certain that what is reported is exactly what Buddha said. But now, science has given all the technology. Each single word, not only the word, but the pauses in between, the very nuances of the words, the way they are uttered, the very gestures, all can be recorded. The words can be recorded, the gestures can be photographed. Films can be made, tapes can be made. Now, the best way is for any enlightened person not to depend on anybody else, although that path is difficult, far more difficult, because you have to do two things together. You have to constantly settle forth and back. You have to constantly go into worldlessness and come out from that emptiness into the world of words. It is a difficult phenomenon. The most difficult phenomenon in the whole of existence. Because when you enter into silence, it is so beautiful that to come back to the universe of words looks absurd, meaningless. It is as if you have reached to the sunlit peaks and then you come back to the dark holes where people live in the valley, the slums. When you have touched the sunlit peaks, when you can live there and you can float like clouds in the infinite sky, to come back to the muddy earth, to crawl again with people who are living in mud, seems to be very absurd, but there is no other way. If you have compassion enough, you have to go into this difficult process. It depends on many things too. It depends on the whole process a master has reached through many lives. Ramakrishna in any of his life was never an intellectual. A simple man. In this life he was a simple man. Even if he wanted, it would have been impossible for him to become a Vivekananda too. It was easier to find somebody who can do that work. Gurdjieff, when he was very young, only 12 years of age, became part of a party of seekers. 30 people. Who made a decision that they will go to the different parts of the world and find out whether truth is only a talk or there are few people who have known it. Just a 12-year-old boy, but he was chosen in the party for the simple reason because he had great stamina. He had great powers. One thing was certain about him. Whatsoever he decides, he will risk all for it. He will not look back. He will never escape. Even if he has to lose his life, he will lose his life. And 3 times, almost, he was shot dead, almost. But he pulled somehow himself back into life. The purpose was he still unfulfilled. Those 30 people traveled all over the world. They came to India, they went to Tibet, and the whole Middle East, all the Sufi monasteries, all the Himalayan monasteries, and they had decided to come back to a certain place in the Middle East and to relate whatsoever they have gained. After each 12 years they were going to meet. First 12 years, and almost half of them did not return. They must have died somewhere. Or forgot the mission. or became entangled somewhere. Somebody must have got married, fallen in love. Thousand and one things can happen. People are accidental. Only 15 people returned back. And the next time after 12 years, only 3 people came back. And the third time, only Gurdjieff was there. All has disappeared. What happened to them, nobody knows. But this man had very great decisiveness. If he had decided, then nothing was going to deter him. He was almost killed 3 times. The only thing that saved him was his mission, that he has to go back. And he pulled himself out of his death. It needed great inner power. He had no time to become an intellectual. He was moving with mystics from one monastery to another monastery, from one cave to another cave, from one country to another country. He came to India. He came to Tibet. He went up to Japan. He gathered from all over the world. By the time he himself became enlightened, there was no time left for him to intellectualize it, to put it into words. He knew the taste, but words were not there. He needed a man like Ouspensky. My own approach has been totally different. I began as an intellectual, not only in this life, but for many lives. My whole work in many lives has been concerned with the intellect, refining the intellect, sharpening the intellect. In this life I began as an atheist, with absolute denial of God. You cannot be an atheist if you are not supra-intellectual. And I was an absolute atheist. People used to avoid me because I was doubting each and everything. And my doubt was contagious. Even my teachers will avoid me. One of my teacher was dying. I went to see him. He said, "Please, I'm happy that you have come, but don't say a single word, because this is not a time. I'm dying, and I want to die believing that God is." I said, "You cannot die seeing me. The doubt has already arisen." He said, "What do you mean?" And the thing started. And before he died, just after 12 hours, he died an atheist. And I was so happy. I had to work 12 hours continuously. Out of desperation, he said, "Okay, let me die peacefully. I say that there is no God. Are you happy? Now leave me alone." My university professors was always at a difficulty. I was expelled from one college to another and then thrown out from one university. Finally, one university admitted me with the condition. I had to sign it, a written condition, that I will not ask any questions and I will not argue with the professors. I said, okay. I signed it, and the Vice Chancellor was very happy, and I said, now, few things. What do you mean by argument? He said, here you go. I have not written in it that I will not ask for any clarification. I can ask for a clarification. What do you mean by an argument? And if I cannot ask a question, what is the point of your whole department of philosophy? Because all your philosophers were asking questions. The whole philosophy depends on doubt. Doubt is the base of all philosophy. If I cannot doubt, your stupid philosophers, your stupid professors, then how I am going to learn philosophy? He said, look what you are saying. You are calling my professors in front of me stupid. I said, they are stupid. Otherwise, why these conditions? Can you think of somebody intelligent asking his students not to question him? Is this a sign of intelligence? A professor will invite questions. An intelligent professor will be happy with his students who can argue well. That remained a problem. My whole approach from the very beginning was not that of a Ramakrishna. I am not a devotional type. Not at all. I have arrived at God through atheism, not through theism. I have arrived at God not by believing in Him, but by absolutely doubting in Him. I have come to a certainty because I have doubted, and I went on doubting till there was no possibility to doubt anymore, till I came across something indubitable. That has been my process. That was not the process of Gurdjieff. He was learning from masters, moving from one master to another master, learning techniques and methods and devices. He learned many devices, but he learned in a very surrendered spirit of a disciple. I have never been a disciple to anybody. Nobody has been my master. In fact, nobody was ready to accept me as a disciple. Because who would like to create trouble? One of my professors,
who is now dead, Dr. S. K. Saxena, he loved me very much. The only man out of all my professors, because I came across many professors, I had to leave many colleges and many universities. Rarely one comes across so many professors as I came across. He is the only man that I had some respect for, because he never prevented me from doubting, from questioning, even though 1001 times he had to accept his defeat. I respected him because he was capable of even accepting defeat from a student. He will simply say, "I accept defeat. You win it. I cannot argue anymore. I have put all argument that I can muster, and you have destroyed them all. Now I am ready to listen to you if you have something to say." He was very much afraid. When I was doing my final MA examination in philosophy, he was very much afraid, because he loved me so much. He wanted me to get through the examination, but he was afraid. Afraid that I may write things which are not according to the textbooks, or against the textbooks. I may say things which are not acceptable to the ordinary professors, just to save me. He gave all the papers to such people all over the country who were his friends, and he informed them that, "Please take care of this young man. Don't be offended by him. That is his way. But he has great potential. Only one thing he could not manage. That was to be decided by the Vice Chancellor himself. The verbal examination. And that was the last thing." And the Vice Chancellor invited a Mohammedan professor from Aligarh University, the head of the department of philosophy there, a very fanatic Mohammedan. My professor was very much worried. He said to me again and again, "Don't argue with this man. In the first place, he is a Mohammedan. Mohammedans don't know what argument is. He is very fanatic. If he cannot argue with you, he will take revenge. And I know he cannot argue. I know him, I know you. But you just remain quiet, because this is the last thing. Don't destroy the whole effort that I have been doing for you." He said to me, "It is not your examination. It seems I am being examined." I said, "I will see." And the first question the Mohammedan professor asked was, "What is the difference between Indian philosophy and Western philosophy?" I said, "This is something stupid. The very idea. This is nonsense. Philosophy is philosophy. How philosophy can be Indian? And how philosophy can be Eastern or Western?"
If science is not Eastern and science is not Western, then why philosophy? Philosophy is a quest for truth. How the quest can be Eastern or Western? Quest is the same. My professor started pulling my leg underneath the table. I said, "Sir, you stop. Don't pull my leg." Forget all about the examination. Now this thing has to be decided. The Mohammedan professor was at a loss, "What is going on?" He said, "What is the matter?" I said, "He is pulling my leg. He is telling me that you are a Mohammedan and a fanatic Mohammedan. And he says, if you cannot argue well with me, you will take revenge. So do whatsoever you want. But I have to say what I feel. I don't believe in all these distinctions. In fact, to me, the very idea of somebody being a philosopher and yet a Mohammedan is simply illogical. It is ridiculous. How can you be a real inquirer if you have already accepted a certain dogma, a certain creed? If you start from a priori assumptions, if you start from a belief, you can never reach to truth. Real philosophy starts in a state of not knowing. And that is the beauty of doubt. It destroys all beliefs. For a moment he was shocked, felt almost dumb. But had to give me 99 marks out of 100. I asked him, "What happened to one?" He said, "This is something, in my whole life I have never given to anybody 99 marks out of 100. And you are asking me what happened to one?" I said, "Yes, when you are giving me 99, I have all the right to ask, why you are so much miserly? Just for one. Make it 100. At least be generous once." He had to make it 100. My whole approach has been a totally different approach than Ramakrishna and Gurdjieff. I have arrived through doubt. I have arrived through deep and profound skepticism. I have arrived not through belief, but through denial of all belief and disbelief too, because disbelief is belief in a negative form. A moment came in my life when all beliefs and all disbeliefs disappeared and I was left utterly empty. In that emptiness, the explosion happened. Hence it is not so difficult for me. So easily I can argue. I can even argue against argument. That's what I am going continuously to do. I can argue against intellect. Because I know how to use intellect. Ramakrishna had never used his intellect. He started from the heart. And the same is the case with Gurdjieff. Buddha could use, because he was the son of a king, well educated, well cultured. All the great philosophers of the country were called to teach him. He knew what intellectual approach is, and then he became fed up with it. The same has happened with me. I know what can be achieved through intellectual effort. Nothing can be achieved through it. When I say it through my own experience. But it has been beautiful in one way. It has not resulted into giving me truth. It cannot give truth to anybody. But in a indirect way, it has cleansed the ground. It has prepared the ground. It has not helped me to realize myself, but it has helped me to communicate whatsoever I have realized. I can communicate with you very easily, with no problems. You can inquire all kinds of questions. You can ask, you can doubt. Because I know all these questions and doubts can be quashed. They can be destroyed. And it is good that you should ask so I can destroy your questions. Once all your questions are destroyed, the answer arises in your own being. In that utter emptiness, something wells up. It is already there. I am not in favor of repressing doubt by believing. You are not here to believe in me. You are here to bring all your disbelief out. Your doubts, your questions, all are respected, welcome. So that they can be taken out from you. Slowly, slowly, a silence, a state of not knowing arises. And the state of not knowing is the state of wisdom, is the state of enlightenment. The second question. I belong to the legal profession and have a very legal mind. can I also become a sannyasin? Sannyas makes no conditions on you. Everybody is welcome, sinner and saint. Legal experts, law breakers, virtuous people, criminals, all are welcome. Sannyas makes no precondition. Although, it will be a little difficult for you. But that is your problem, not my problem. If you belong to the legal profession and have a very legal mind, then it is going to be a little difficult for you. So what? Accept it as a challenge. Let it be difficult. In fact, the more difficult it is, the more challenging it is, the more it should be interesting, intriguing. It should be more attractive. When something is very simple, who wants to do it? When something is difficult, it provokes a challenge in you. It provokes intelligence in you. It is difficult, certainly difficult, for a person who has a legal mind, because a legal mind means a cunning mind. It is not necessarily intelligent. In fact, if it is intelligent, it will not be cunning. Cunningness is a poor substitute for intelligence. And legal profession is the most cunning profession in the world. It is known that Jesus moved with drunkards and gamblers and even a prostitute. But I have not heard that he moved with legal experts. In fact, the Jewish rabbi is nothing but a legal expert. Because Jewish religion is more or less law and less religion. It is more or less legal code. It has not much metaphysics. It has not great flights. It is very earthly. It tells you in detail what to do and what not to do. Those 10 commandments, that may have been the beginning of the legal profession. You can become a sannyasin. Even if the desire has arisen in you, there seems to be a spark of intelligence. Behind all your cunningness, there must be a little fire still left. Don't be worried. Come into this orange fire. It burns everything. It will burn you too. It consumes everything. It will consume the legal expert too. Just if you are ready to be consumed, if you are ready to drop your cunningness, because that will have to be dropped, not that I say it is a condition, but as you will become a sannyasin, and as you will move into meditation, you will start becoming more and more intelligent, and then naturally, as a byproduct, cunningness disappears. If the legal profession disappears from the world, 90% cunningness will disappear with it. It is the people who know the law which go on creating confusion. One of my vice chancellors was a great law expert, world-renowned law expert. He used to tell again and again that once it happened in Privy Council, he was fighting a case for an Indian Maharaja, and he was such a drunkard. And the last night he had drunk too much. The hangover was still there. So he forgot whether he is against the Maharaja or for the Maharaja. So for 1 hour, he spoke against the Maharaja. The Maharaja was perspiring. His assistants were trembling, what he is doing. And in the tea break, they told him, what have you done? You have destroyed our client. Now there is no way to save him. He said, what has happened? You have been speaking against our own client. He said, don't be worried. There is still time. And then when the court started again, he said, you heard me, your honors, for 1 hour. Thank you for your patience. Because I was giving all those arguments that are possible from the opposite side. Now, I will defend my client. And he destroyed his own arguments and won the case. The legal expert has no dedication to truth. He does not care about truth. See, he simply cares whosoever pays the money. He is far worse than a prostitute. The prostitute only sells her body. And the legal expert sells his mind. He is ready to be purchased by anybody, whosoever is ready to pay the price. He does not care what is right and what is wrong. But if you become a meditator, you will start caring what is right and what is wrong. Not that you will have to. Not that it is a commandment. Not that it is something like a character that has to be cultivated. But naturally it happens that cunningness starts disappearing. So you have to be alerted. You can become a sannyasin. There is no problem for me. I never ask anybody who you are. If you want to take sannyas, I give you sannyas unconditionally. Out of my love, I give you sannyas. Out of my respect for you, I give sannyas. I respect each and every individual, because to me each and every individual represents godliness. Even if the god has fallen very low and has become a legal expert, still the god is a god. Even in your fallen state, Divakar, I respect you. I will give you sannyas. It is for you to decide, because this is risky. Risky for you, for your profession. In the days of the Raj in India, a British soldier was expected to do his duty and very little else. Any display of human weakness by the troops was regarded as letting the side down in front of the natives. So naturally, the new commanding officer was very worried when an angry crowd of Hindus approached the barracks, complaining that one of their sacred cows had been outraged by an infantryman. They demanded an immediate court-martial. "Don't worry, sir," said an experienced law expert. "Our man is bound to get off. This cow has a very bad reputation. It has already been cited in 7 previous cases." You get the idea? You will have to drop such legal expertise. You will have to drop such cunning approach. You will have to become more human. But those are consequences of meditation. Nothing is imposed here. Just the other day, I was reading an article written by a bishop in London Times against me. He says, "Beware of this man." He quotes me that this man says that character is the concern of the stupid. The really intelligent people are only concerned with consciousness. He is quoting me to make people beware, because this is a dangerous statement. He says, rather than publishing articles on this man, Times should publish more articles on Mother Teresa of Calcutta, who teaches character. And character is the only thing, the real thing. Character is not the real thing at all. But the poor bishop has not been able to understand what I have been telling. He does not understand the consequences of consciousness. Character is a consequence of consciousness. If character comes out of your consciousness, then it has a beauty of its own. If it is just imposed from the outside, then it is ugly. But that's what Christians are doing all over the world. And Hindus and Mohammedans, they are all in the same boat. My whole concern is consciousness. I teach you how to be more conscious. Because I know one thing for certain, that if you are more conscious, your character will change on its own accord. A conscious person lives in a totally different way. He is more compassionate. Mother Teresa of Calcutta is not compassionate, behaves compassionately, but is not compassionate. Or her compassion is nothing but a means to reach to heaven and to reduce compassion into a means is ugly. Compassion is an end unto itself. An ancient Taoist parable says, a man fell into a well. He started shouting loudly, "Save me, I'm drowning." A Buddhist monk passed by. He looked in the well and he said, "Be calm, be quiet. Don't be disturbed. Life is a flux. It comes, it goes. And remember what Gautam the Buddha has said. It is all dream. Your drowning is a dream, my seeing is a dream. Don't shout. And even if you are saved, what is the point? Sooner or later you will have to die. So why not now? Why postpone it? Die silently, peacefully, so that you are not born again. Get out of the wheel of birth and death." The man was aghast. He said, "What nonsense you are talking. You can sermonize later on. First take me out. This is no time to teach me great philosophy." But the Buddhist said, "I cannot be distracted by things." The Buddha has said, "Walk on. Undistracted. Goodbye." And he walked on, undistracted. Then a Confucian monk looked in the well, and the man said, "Now please save me. Don't waste time." And the Confucian monk said, "Do you know what the master has said?" Confucius has said that each well should have a protective wall around it. You don't be worried. I will create great movements all over the country so that no well is unprotected like this." The man said, "But that is not going to save me." The Confucian monk said, "It is not a question of individuals." The master says the question is always of the society. The question is of the future. Think of the future and think of the society. Don't be so selfish. And he went into the marketplace and he started teaching to the people that look for the example. What has happened? Our master has said before that each well should have a protective wall. He is always right. But people have not listened to the master and they are suffering. Then a Christian missionary looks into the well and the man said, "It seems my death is certain. Today no layman is coming by the side. Now you will teach me your gospel." But the Christian said, "Don't be worried." Out of his bag, he pulled a rope, threw the rope in, told the man to tie the rope around his waist and he will pull him. The man was surprised. No metaphysics, no religion. He was pulled out. He was very thankful. He fell into his feet. And he said, "You are the only really religious person. But only one curiosity. How come you were carrying a rope in your bag?" He said, "We always keep all kinds of arrangements with us. Who knows what opportunity arises to serve? Because service is religion. And it is through serving people that one can reach to heaven." "I am not concerned with you," said the missionary. "My concern is my own place in heaven. Now I have scores. In fact, I am grateful to you. Go on falling. Help us poor missionaries to serve you. And go on teaching your children. And don't listen to these Confucian people who say that every well needs a wall to protect it. If every well has a wall, nobody will fall. And then how we are going to save people? And without saving people, there is no way to heaven. Go on falling in the well. Go on making wells without walls. Teach your children to fall. Because unless we serve you, there is no way to God. Don't laugh at it. This is a real situation. Just think, if there is no poverty in India, no orphans, no paralyzed people, no people suffering from leprosy, where will be Mother Teresa of Calcutta? Then no Nobel Prize either. These people are needed to create a Mother Teresa. These missionaries will not like a world where all are rich, happy. Bertrand Russell used to say, and I agree with him absolutely, that much of religion will disappear if world becomes rich. People are healthy. People live long lives. People's life are joyous. Much of religion will disappear. He is true. Because much of religion depends on all these things. Particularly Christianity depends totally on these things. Now that bishop in London is telling that Mother Teresa is doing great work. But how you will do great work if poor people are no more there, if blind people are not there, if lepers are not there, what you are going to do? The missionaries will be at a loss. You have to keep this world in the same misery and mess as it is. Just think of poor missionaries, otherwise they will be nowhere. My concern is certainly consciousness, not character. My concern is to make you more aware, alert. And out of that alertness, whatsoever happens is good. If out of that alertness service happens, it is good. Love happens, it is good. Compassion happens, it is good. Sharing happens, it is good. Because out of that awareness, evil is impossible. I am not concerned what you are doing. My whole concern is with your being, not with your doing. The last question. No, I don't get it. Breeches, roar, what? Am I just dumb or something? Neither you are dumb or something. Either you are British, or you must have been British in your past life. A 75-year-old British field marshal tells his adjutant to bring his brigade to attention and announces, "Gentlemen, I am proud to tell you that 08:30 Greenwich time, my wife gave birth to a 7.5-pound baby boy. Gentlemen, I thank you." Get it? This very proper Englishman walks into a pet shop. As he closes the door behind him, he hears a voice welcoming him. "I know something about you. I know something about you." Embarrassed, he looks around and finds that it is but a parrot. Impressed, he asks to buy the bird. "So sorry, sir," replies the owner. "Cannot sell it. But I can sell you a couple of eggs, which after incubation will give you the same breed." The man buys the eggs, takes them home, and puts them in the incubator. After 10 days, 2 little ducklings crawl out of the egg cells. Furious, he goes back to the shop to complain. As he enters, he hears, "I know something about you. I know something about you." He hurries over to the parrot, looks it straight in the eye and says, "Shut up! I know something about you too." Katina, get it? Or not yet? An Englishman and a Scotsman were sharing a train compartment with a lady and her pretty daughters.
on entering a pitch black tunnel, a smacking kiss and a slap is heard. And as they come out into daylight, the Englishman thinks, damn it, the Scot kissed her and I got paid off. The lady thinks, God Almighty, one of these fellows kissed my daughter. But the good girl knew what to do. Whoever it was, he got his punishment. The girl thinks, pity, one of these fellows tried to kiss me and got my mother instead. Thinks the Scot, comes the next tunnel, I will kiss my hand again and give that English prick another whacking slap. Enough for today.